Welcome to Season 2 and another edition of The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, I'm Linda Chalker Scott, and welcome back to Season 2 of The Informed Gardener. As your personal Extension Urban Horticulturist, I'll help you understand the information articles about plant science so you can apply it to your own garden. Every week we try to follow a theme throughout the podcast, and this week's theme is winter winners. During our interview, we'll take you on a virtual tour through a lovely winter garden with plant taxonomist Dr. Sarah Reichert. But first, let's look at winter winners in the news. Well, both of our articles today are from ScienceDaily.com, and the first one is entitled Killing Crop-Eating Pests: Compounds Work by Disrupting Bugs' Winter Sleep. Now, all gardeners know that insects have different life forms. We've seen them all in our garden, some of them we like and some of them maybe not so much. There's a larva, which then changes into a pupa and then eventually changes into the adult. And these immature forms, the larvae and pupa, are the ones that cause most of the damage to your garden. Well, the one that overwinters, if you have an overwintering form, is the pupa. And this is the one that burrows underground and it turns into a little cocoon type of structure and then eventually emerges. And the way that this works is very much like with plants or with animals, with this whole dormancy process. But in insects, it's actually called diapause rather than dormancy. When insects enter dormancy, there's a hormone or sometimes more than one hormone that actually controls the process. So they go to sleep for the winter, they spend winter underground where they're kept from freezing, and then they're woken up and they emerge as adults and then complete their life cycle by mating and laying eggs. It's not usually the adults that are much of the problem in the garden, although some adult insects are problems, but a lot of the larvae cause much death and destruction to plants every year. And one particular pest, and this is called the corn earworm, infests over 100 different plant species, most of them very important crop species, and costs somewhere around $2 billion a year in treatment or in pesticide spraying. And this is a huge loss for farmers. And plus, you know, you're using a lot of pesticides in this. So researchers have been looking at ways of trying to control the insect's life cycle rather than just find the newest pesticide. So they've found some neat compounds that actually disrupt hibernation. And this works in a variety of different ways. So these compounds are actually hormone triggers, and they trick the insect's body into thinking that it's some other time of year than what it really is. So they react as if the diapause hormone has been turned on. And this manifests itself in a couple of different ways. One is that they never go to sleep. So rather than going dormant and being burrowed underground, they stay awake and they actually starve to death because they're still metabolizing and using up all of their energy reserves. Or there's some of these compounds that cause insects to wake up early and emerge too early, and then they're vulnerable to harsh weather like late freezes and they die. And there's some of these things that cause insects to never wake up at all. And all three of these things could be described as ecological suicide. And the reason that researchers use that term is because in all three cases, the insects never reach maturity and they can never reproduce. And so eventually that population of insects would die back. So in contrast, the insecticides, which we know are not the greatest things to use environmentally, and insects also develop resistance to insecticides, the hormone trigger actually causes the insect to fight itself. So rather than developing a resistance to some chemical, the insect would have to develop a resistance to its own hormones, and that's going to be pretty tough to overcome. Now, the trick right now that the researchers are facing is how to get the hormone trigger to the pupa. They've been doing this research in the lab where it's really easy just to inject the pupa with the hormone trigger. But you remember that these guys are burrowed underground, so somehow we've got to get hormone trigger to the larvae before it burrows underground and turns into a pupa. So what they're hoping to do eventually with these corn earworms anyway is to deliver these hormone triggers in their food so that they're carrying it along with them, and then after they burrow and turn into a pupa, then the trigger works its magic. Sometimes I just have to wonder if researchers get their ideas from childhood fairy tales. Doesn't a corn earworm eating poison food and never waking up remind you of Snow White? The second story from ScienceDaily.com is entitled Fewer Yellowjacket Wasp Surprises on Christmas Trees. Well, as in many other parts of the country, Hawaiians also celebrate Christmas with Christmas trees, but they don't have a lot of their own conifers, and so they end up importing these from other states in the country, including here in Washington State. But unfortunately for Hawaiians, there's often stowaways on these Christmas trees, including hibernating yellow jacket queens. Now, gardeners are very familiar with yellow jackets. We are familiar with most of our bees and wasps, and many of them, including yellow jackets, are beneficial, but yellow jackets are really pretty vicious, and we tend to avoid them. Most of the time, they're burrowed in the ground. They have underground nests, and you know that if you've ever stumbled across one accidentally, and you all of a sudden have developed a whole new group of friends. But the queens, if they haven't developed a nest yet, oftentimes will hibernate in trees. So they crawl into the branches of trees where they're very protected from predators, and they go dormant, and they wait until the next year. So what happens in the spring, normally they'll wake up just like the other insects we talked about, and they fly off into their new environment and find themselves a place to nest. Well, now imagine if you're a yellow jacket queen on a Christmas tree that's been harvested and taken to Hawaii, where it's much warmer, then you'd wake up and fly around to try to find a new nesting site. Well, unfortunately, in Hawaii, there are not native populations of yellow jackets, and so yellow jackets are considered to be invasive pest species, even though they're beneficial insects. The reason is they're so beneficial in terms of eating insect pests that they compete with the native birds for their food, and then a lot of the birds then would have problems keeping their populations going. So the long and the short of it is that yellow jackets are a controlled species in Hawaii. They really don't like spraying the trees with insecticides because even though that will kill the queen, they're really looking for chemical-free methods of controlling this particular insect. So what they've looked at is something very low-tech, and I always love seeing low-tech, and it's a tree-shaking program. So they've tried both mechanical and manual shaking. So they put it into some kind of machine and would just shake and shake and shake and shake until all of these sleeping queens would fall out of the tree. And it turned out that mechanical shaking was much, much more effective than manual shaking. So now, because of this research, Hawaii officials now require all trees that are coming into the country for Christmas trees to be shaken before they are sold to the public. And this whole shaking idea, again, very low tech, is probably a good idea if you happen to be like my family and harvest your own Christmas tree every year. Because even though everyone likes surprises under your Christmas tree, yellow jackets probably aren't one of them.
Shake, 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 Sinora, shake your body line. Whoop. Shake, 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 Sinora, shake it all the time. Work, 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 Sinora, work your body line. Work, 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 Sinora, work it all the time.
Those of you that live in places like Seattle, that far north, know that winters can be very long and dark. And nothing can brighten your landscape or your spirits like a really well-designed winter garden. So this week, I visited Seattle's Washington Park Arboretum's winter garden with Dr. Sarah Reichert, who's the director of UW's Botanical Garden. So we're at the Washington Park Arboretum with Director Sarah Reichert. And I just have to ask, is a winter garden full of snowberry?
A winter garden is a garden that's designed to be beautiful during the months that we don't really think about being in the garden, from really late November into March. So we choose plants that have flowers in the winter, and there are some, and they tend to be very fragrant. We choose plants that have beautiful berries, colorful leaves, interesting bark. It's plants that just are really remarkable and shine during those dim winter months.
So this looks familiar because I have one, but it's about 4 feet tall.
This is Garia issaquiensis, and it's named after the town of Issaquah, which is where the cultivar was first found. It's a cross between, a hybrid between two different species of Garia that were growing in someone's garden in Issaquah. And what's really remarkable about this one is this has male and female plants. The male flowers are what are called catkins. They're very long, sometimes 8 inches long, dangling groups of flowers. And when they're at their peak, which they're not quite right now, but when they're at their peak, more like January, February, they're going to be this gorgeous mauve color. So you've got these beautiful, long, dangling, hanging pink things coming off of an evergreen shrub. It's one of my favorites for the wintertime. One of my other favorites in the winter garden is this one over here, which is Azara microphylla. It's an evergreen. It's a tall evergreen tree shrub. And it has very small leaves, hence the name microphylla. It's not a beautiful plant, so it's kind of shaggy, really, in a way. So it's a plant that you probably want to put towards the back of the garden and not make a focal. But what's so cool about it is if you come back here again in about February, it's going to have little tiny flowers on it that you won't see, but they smell like chocolate.
Oh, cool.
Just like chocolate. They are so cool. And it's so fun to stand here during those months when it's in flower and walk people walking by and then stop and look around. Like, where's that chocolate bar? I want some of that. And then, of course, they won't see it. So it's really cool. That's one of the typical things about winter flowering plants is that they are very fragrant because there are not many insect pollinators that are active in the winter months. And so the plants that flower in the winter have to be super competitive to attract those pollinators. So they tend to be very fragrant. So this is one example of it. Many of the Daphne species also flower in the wintertime and are very fragrant as well.
I want to know what pollinates a chocolate-smelling plant.
Maybe you?
Could be. You may see me flitting around here later on.
So there are many different cultivars and a few different species in the genus Hamamelis, which are these V-shaped shrubs that we're standing in front of here. They are deciduous, so this time of year they don't have any leaves on them. But pretty soon, you can see these buds on them now, pretty soon the flowers are going to unroll and they're going to be, the petals are very narrow and they're like crinkled tissue paper. They're very distinctive and they come in a range of colors of yellows and oranges and reds. Really, really distinctive. Now, many of them are fragrant. Not all of the Hamamelises are fragrant, but many of them are. Another shrub that we're standing in front of is one of the Mahonias or Berberises. This is a cultivar called Arthur Menzies, which actually was developed here at the Washington Park Arboretum. And what's distinctive about it, there's a few things. One is the evergreen leaves are what are called pinnately compound, which means they have little leaflets that are somewhat arranged like a feather is, so coming off of a central stem. And what's really distinctive is you can see these upright flowers that are starting to form, these inflorescences which are starting to form at the ends. These will be open again in January, and they're bright yellow, and they are hummingbird magnets. Mm. Now, people don't think of yellow flowers as being hummingbird magnets, but they will come and just zoom right to these, and they will fight over it like hummingbirds do. They get really excited about the flowers of the Arthur Menzies Berberis Mahonia.
I have to say, I really like the bark on it, too. It's a really yep. nice striped bark.
The bark is fantastic. It's got this sort of, it's very deeply indented, and it's got kind of a network to it. So, yeah, I agree. The bark is one of the best features of it. And we have many of these throughout the arboretum, as you might expect. And some of them are older than this one, and you really get a wonderful veining on that the bark.
And that's one of the things that you really look for in a winter garden, isn't it? A lot of mm-hmm. bark interest.
Yeah, it is. In fact, why don't we go over and look at a couple that are really great for bark.
Okay. There is a squirrel up there.
Yep, there's a very fat squirrel who's eating the maple leaves and is a little upset with us, you can tell. So this is a grouping of a birch species as well as a maple species. This garden was designed, it was redesigned by Ian Robertson, a landscape architecture professor at the University of Washington in the late 80s. And this is one of my favorite parts of the winter garden that he designed. He put these plants in here that have a very distinctive shaggy bark that peels off. The bark is very thin, and in wintertime it peels off and it hangs in these shreds from the trees. And what's really great about this site is that it's facing sort of southwest, which is where the sun is in the wintertime. And unfortunately, these western red cedars have gotten a bit tall over the last few years. But even so, the sun, it's designed so that the sun comes through here in the afternoon and shines through this bark.
Yeah.
And oh my God, it is so beautiful on a sunny day in the wintertime. This is just unbelievable. It's so funny because I've taken lots of pictures of them, and I was mentioning that to somebody, and he says, oh, I have too, and he sent me, and they could have been the same photo. So people are really drawn to this. It's just a really beautiful part of the winter garden.
Yeah, and I hadn't even really thought about that, placing it so things like this that are kind of translucent to have the sun come through. I mean, it really does brighten things up.
It really brightens things up. And this Acer that we have here, Acer griseum, is one that it's one of my favorites because the bark is really a rich cinnamon brown color, and it's very shaggy. So when you get the sun coming through it, it just resonates with the red. It's just spectacular. We really are making this squirrel very unhappy, aren't we?
He looks like about ready to throw something at us.
I think he might be.
So these look familiar, too, because I have a whole bunch of them in my backyard.
Yeah, these are hellebores, and hellebores are another fun winter flowering plant. They're a herbaceous perennial, and they begin to flower, depending on the species, December through February or so. Most of them probably in January and February. Really vibrant colors, a lot of rich pinks and just whites. I like to go hellebore shopping in January and February when they're in flower, because the flowers are so variable that you really can't buy like a known cultivar and be sure you're going to get something. You really need to go and buy it in flower to make sure you get the one that you want. In my garden, I have a steep staircase that I call the hellebore climb. And every year I go and buy more hellebores and plant them along the staircase. The idea being that as you slowly make your way up this steep staircase, you can stop and pretend to be enjoying the flowers while you catch your breath.
Well, the funny thing is, and this is, I guess, how plant tastes change. I can remember, I mean, I grew up in this area, and I don't remember ever seeing hellebores. In fact, after I'd moved away and then came back in the late 90s, I think that was the first time I ever saw hellebores at all.
Well, I would give Dan Hinckley from Heronswood Nursery big credit for that. He was really interested in hellebores, and he had some staff that were very good at hybridizing them, and he started coming up with some really interesting hellebores. And I think that made them a lot more popular, because suddenly there was a lot more variety in what was being offered.
Yeah, because it was just about, like, what, two or three before him.
Exactly. And not very exciting. No. And so I can remember he used to have in February, he'd have a when they were in flower, he'd have the hellebore open, which was a benefit for the Miller Library at the Center for Urban Horticulture. And I would always go, and I can remember one of the hellebore opens, I was scanning across the tables, and I saw this one that was like this beautiful, rich, reddish color. And I made a beeline to it, and I grabbed it just as another woman was coming from another direction who obviously had done the same thing I did. And I, like, kind of grabbed it and looked at her, and she looked at me, and I'm like, too bad. It's fine.
Well, I was going to guess this was a rhododendron, but it's not like any rhododendron I've ever seen.
This may be my favorite rhododendron. I actually have two of them in my garden. I don't have many rhododendrons. This is Rhododendron strigulosum, and there's a few things that I love about it. One of these petioles. Look at these petioles.
That's so cool.
They've got really long, stiff hairs on them that look like eyelashes or something. I don't know, but I just love these petioles. And I made sure when I planted mine that they were right like this, right by a path, so you could stop and pet them. But the other thing that's cool about it is that the flowers are not your typical three-story pink hybrid rhododendron that everyone in Seattle knows about. These are long, probably 3 to 4 inch long, very tubular, bright red, waxy petals.
Sounds very tropical.
You know, it kind of is. It kind of is. But it's just a really beautiful flower, and it's, again, another hummingbird magnet. Not very fragrant. Most rhododendrons aren't. But really just a wonderful plant in the garden for the winter. I love mine. Now, what's odd is that I have two of them, and they're growing side by side. I did get them from different places, but one of them is amazingly drought-hardy, and the other one, I call it my garden drama queen. It's kind of my indicator plant for knowing when I need to start thinking about watering my garden, because it just gets dramatically limp, and the leaves just droop down. So, but Rhododendron strigulosum is a great rhododendron for a winter garden.
Well, you know what I like about it so much, and I'm looking at it down on top of some of them, it's so symmetrical, and it's you know, the leaves are quite different the way they're arranged, and then you've got the flower bud in the center, and then you've got these little whiskery things on the petioles, and it's just a really nice symmetrical picture. I mean, it's very, very magnetic that way.
It is. It is a very tidy rhododendron.
Mm-hmm. It is, and rhododendrons do not tend to be tidy plants. Well, again, we could be standing in my garden maybe 100 years from now. I've got one of these, but it's about 3 feet tall.
So this is a kind of hazelnut, a European hazelnut, and the cultivar name is Harry Lauder's Walking Stick. And I don't know who Harry Lauder was, but this is a crazy curly branch tree. So each one of the branches is extremely gnarled. Not really good walking stick material, in my opinion, but it's a beautiful shrub in the wintertime. It is deciduous, so it's in the process of losing its leaves right now. In a few weeks, it'll be completely bare. And what you will see just be these twisty branches. And then again, come February and March, you're going to have long dangling catkins, much like the Garia, and it's going to be covered with them. So it is a shrub that I think is a wonderful architectural element in the garden, and it's part of the reason it's right in the center of the winter garden, is it is such an amazingly architectural statement.
It really is cool, and I see that it's got the one problem that I have with it is the same problem I'm sure we all do, is it tends to sucker from the roots, and you always have to cut off those straight branches, which just seems so odd.
Well, maybe those are the walking sticks.
Maybe that's what it is. Well, I know that one of the plants that people love to have in their spring garden, if not their winter garden, are camellias. So what do you think?
Well, you know, there are different species and cultivars of camellias. So I think the one that I know you have and I have talked about before is Camellia japonica, and that's the most common one. The big pink, you know, flowers that cover it, and then because we live in a wet climate, they start to rot while they're still on the plant, and you get these brown flowers that are all gooshy, and it's just icky. Yeah, that's Camellia
gooshy
japonica.
Icky, nice scientific language.
Exactly.
There.
Exactly. Well, you know, it describes, everyone knows what I mean.
Yep, yep.
But there are some other ones that are actually quite nice. So there is Camellia sasanqua, which does bloom earlier. It's a more delicate-looking shrub, a little bit narrower leaves, and it's a more delicate-looking flower, too, and it tends to not get as gooshy. It doesn't tend to get the brown rot on it. And then there is a hybrid, Camellia williamsii, that also doesn't tend to get the rot as well. And so camellias, you know, people, they're not the greatest plant for our climate, but if you grow the sasanqua and the williamsii, they're not too bad. And you can also grow Camellia sinensis, which I know you like, because that's the kind of tea that you drink.
Right.
And we actually can grow that in this climate. And actually, there are people that are selecting cultivars of it that will actually grow very well here. That the idea being that we can actually have locally produced tea. Exactly.
Excellent.
Exactly. You remember last week we interviewed some nursery shoppers about great gardening gifts that they like to give or receive. So to continue with this theme, I thought I'd throw in some rather uncommon gift ideas from me. So I have five of them for you. These are some of my favorite five things, and they're not your typical thing on a gardener's shopping list, but you might enjoy them, or your gardening friends might. My very favorite thing is my mulch fork. I have an amazing mulch fork. This isn't some 3 to 4 tine wimpy little fork. This is a 10 curved tine puppy that can lift a ton of mulch, but it's really well balanced. It has a comfortable wooden handle. I love just holding it. It's just such a comfortable tool to use, and it moves mulch like you wouldn't believe. They're not cheap. They're under $100, but they're pretty expensive, well worth the cost. I've had the same fork now for over 10 years, and there's not a scratch on it. Well, there's some scratches on it, but there's not a lot of damage on it. Let's put it that way. My second favorite idea are rain barrels. And there's some discussion about whether rain barrels really do that much good or not, because they only hold about 55 gallons of water, which isn't very much, and it doesn't go very far in the summer. But look at it this way. It's 55 gallons that you're not using from your hose. It's 55 gallons that's not running down the storm drains, and it keeps on refilling. So over the course of a year, it's much more than 55 gallons that you're saving either from your hose or from running off into the street. Now, you want to check local resources for finding these things. You can buy rain barrels easily in garden centers or off the web, and they can be very expensive. But I actually bought mine from a guy on Craigslist who'd made them out of recycled olive oil drums, which is a safe food product, and he retrofitted them for collecting and dispensing rainwater. So we have two of them, and they cost, I think, less than $100 for both of them. They're great rain barrels. The third thing that is one of my indispensable tools is my long-handled weeder. Now, this is sometimes called a dandelion weeder, and you'd recognize it's very long. At the very end, there's a little fork, a little two-tine fork that gets underneath the bottoms of those long dandelion taproots. It's great for weeds of any species, though. You get under them, horsetails, whatever you want, you pop them out, and it really takes a lot out of that weed root biomass so that they don't come back. Then I love my tarp. Now, tarps don't sound very exciting, but I have a tarp that I use. Actually, I've got several of them. Sometimes I'll use it to cover soil so it doesn't wash away if I haven't finished mulching it, or if it's a pile of soil from excavation. I use it for moving big transplants. You can put the whole root mass on top and then drag it along the ground. You can use it to move mulch. It's just a wonderful type of thing to have. We actually got our very first garden tarp as a wedding present, and it lasted for 20 years before it finally wore out. And then finally, I love my cement mixing tub. Now, it's not for making cement. I actually use this for doing my root washing. So if you're a root washer and you'd like to get all the stuff off the roots of your trees and shrubs, the clay and all the media, one of these cement mixing tubs, they're inexpensive, easy to find at a hardware store, and indispensable for those of us that love to wash our roots. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, TheInformedGardener.com. It's my official Washington State University webpage, and it's full of great and free information. You'll also find archived podcasts from our first season there. Second, please join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog. It's at GardenProfessors.com, and the four of us take turns posting on just about any gardening topic you can imagine. You can even add comments if you feel so inclined. And finally, for those of you who will never give up books until they're pried from your cold, dead hands, I've written three books that might be of interest: The Informed Gardener, The Informed Gardener blooms again, and Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. You can find out more information on all three of these books at sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I hope you found this podcast entertaining and useful. I welcome listener comments and questions, and please email me at lindacs@wsu.edu. Be sure to listen next time when our theme will be Winter Weather Worries.